For the record, we are recording now, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Give it about another minute here.
Joel Walensky is joining as we speak.
I don't quite know everybody by face. Who is my league's iPhone?
That's me, James Wiggs.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Move forward here. Good evening. I call this meeting to order. Today is Thursday, October 15th, 2020. It's 6:02 p.m. And I'd like to call the Planning Commission to order. I would like to note that due to the Governor's Proclamation 20-28, the Planning Commission will hold the regularly scheduled meetings via conference until further notice. We'll start off with a roll call. Vicki Malloy, here.
I'm here.
Will Wiggs.
James,
here. Ryan Kelso, I'm present. Jim Newberry. I'm not seeing Jim. Ed Martinez.
Here.
Joel Walensky.
Here.
Carl Blum.
I'm here.
And Pat Hammersmith.
Here.
Thank you. Start off with some administrative items dealing with meeting minutes from September 23rd, seeing if everyone's had an opportunity to review the meeting minutes from our past meeting. Yep. And if so, any discussion or?
I'd like to just basically put a point of clarification.
Sure.
There was a significant amount of discussion around the areas affected by the sunset zoning. And I think one of the confusions was around the fact that whether or not some of the areas after, let's say, for example, the sunsets were all eliminated from that area, whether or not it would regress back to a 5%. And I just wanted to make sure that everybody was clear that someone did come in and say, yes, it would revert back to a P1. And so what we voted on essentially was to eliminate the sunset clause. And that included the fact that it would revert back to a P1. All those boxes would not go blank. They would revert back to P1s. And I want to make sure that that's clear and on the record, and that that particular measure failed.
Correct. That's my understanding.
Okay.
So to be clear, Ed, and you had corresponded with me individually about this by email, and I said to bring it up to the group would be the proper process. If there's no disagreement, then we'll make that edit to the, I'll hand off this edit to the note taker here, and we'll make the appropriate edit to the for the minutes and bring it back for the next meeting.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other items amongst the rest of the commissioners of notes that might be different? Okay, hearing none, we'll table that to come back at our next scheduled meeting to be re-reviewed. Next item would be a public comment period. If there's anyone in the attendance that would like to talk or bring up any items we're not covering today, that are not on today's agenda, you may do so at this time.
You do so by raising your hand. If you go up and click by your name on the screen, you should be able to see a choice of options next to your name. To get there, you click the participants list at the bottom. It will pull up the list of participants in the Zoom call. If find your name and then click on that. And one of the options under more will be to raise your hand. Or you may see a raise your hand at the bottom of the column. The user mode, as the way we see it, is slightly different than those of you in the public who have a user console. But find a way to signal by raising your hand for that other item not on the agenda if you want to testify for a couple minutes. I'm not seeing anything from anybody. Having seen none, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. We will move on to old business. Deliberation and discussion of short-term rentals. Kind of where we left off last week, or not last week, a few weeks ago, we were discussing various options as we were reading through the code. Primarily, I think where we kind of left off and got stuck on was dealing with the use and activity under which zoning district. And staff and Lisa have provided some document to us, which maybe are you planning on doing that, like a little slideshow through that?
That wasn't our plan, Mr. Chair. Our plan was to pull it up as we did last time as a document. The slideshow that was sent out to you was only a presentation at an extremely high level showing the different categories. Lisa will be able to walk through that, but though that was received at the last minute, that was only so that those of you who like to have a printed copy and not have it take up your entire screen and focus on the screen would have it for you. Otherwise, it's to go through a very short number of slides to talk about possible options for you to consider. Prior to doing so, as I said in my memo that accompanies as the cover sheet to the packet, we're effectively, as I think as you know, out of time given the docket challenges that we have coming up behind this. So I was suggesting you have a range of options how you might want to proceed. We can either just start walking through the code, or maybe there's some level of comfort around certain sections of the code that you may want to vote on, whether you want to take any kind of a vote, either in total or not, to see and get a pulse of where you want to focus your energy given the limited amount of time we have left. Because our hope was that we finish this tonight. My direction from the county commissioners is that I need to get this completed before I can move through the docket, but we've got comp plan amendments and things coming up at the end of the month that we need to go for. So I'm hopeful that if for some reason that there's a continued impasse, that you would consider the option of striking sections of your draft code in favor of coming up with a version of draft code that you could forward to the commissioners and then let them re-engage on those issues that were struck if by chance they feel they need to be incorporated in a final version of the code. These are all just suggestions for you, but I'm trying to help focus your efforts and time in a way that might be more helpful and might reduce some of the frustrations in getting through the complexity of the code.
Thank you, Jim. And I do have a question though with this as we go forward. And I did forward a document to everyone earlier today or this afternoon. And just curious to, in some of the items that we're suggesting and going through, has staff or have you guys looked at impacts of some of this dealing with that RCW, the 3670A? Specifically item 0.40 number 2, dealing with how it impacts property rights and how the Washington State General Attorney of Counsel had put together a document of different items that they felt that should be looked at when making decisions such as what we're doing.
So I am familiar with the document prior to today. Have referred to this document in the past with regard to general work that we do in the department about case law regarding considerations about takings One of the things that you have to consider, again, caveat, not an attorney, work with attorneys all the time, both in the development sector and at the prosecutor's office as our advisory. But one of the challenges is when you look at a document like this, for example, the reference item 3 on page 15, where it talks about regulation that's an action to deny or substantially diminish a fundamental attribute of a property right. When you read the text of the guidance, it talks about denying opportunities from ownership or possession of property, or denying a right to transfer property. And none of the things that we're doing in the draft code is an outright denial of transfer or denying people opportunities to have a use of the property. It's simply restricting the use, much like a rezone might take a situation where you might have been able to operate a some sort of a commercial business in a neighborhood, and that changes, that zoning changes, and maybe you're non-conforming and continue to operate, but that non-conformance is under a tight set of circumstances that don't carte blanche just automatically transfer over in every circumstance, that there are some restrictions that attach to that. So at a high level general sense of the things that you have in the code draft currently, they could be that way, but you're talking about matters of law and whether a court would look at it in a certain way, whether there's existing case law that might govern how that would be viewed at, whether there's no case law with regard to the example of short-term rentals as it applies to Washington law.
Would not sunsetting be one of those items, though, that we're discussing that would create that?
It could, but my recommendation to you would be that the prosecutor's office works directly with the Board of Commissioners, and that if you have a reservation about something because of that, I would suggest that you not invest too much time on it, because there's so many legal angles that you can't and I can't know, because we're not attorneys and we're not studying it at that level. When we get to that point with the Board of Commissioners, they will be considering those matters, and the prosecutor's office will be directly engaged with them. If you're not able to establish a level of comfort because of concerns about that, it is certainly your option to strike those sections of the code and not have it go forward in the draft code that you pass. And then the Board of Commissioners can decide whether those are items that they want to consider in their final drafting and deliberations.
Mr. Chair, may I say something?
Sure.
It was 61 pages long. I only got partially through it. But in the warning, the page 3 of the takings document that you basically says legal counsel should be consulted for advice of whether or not a particular action may result in an unconstitutional taking of property. So there's that. And then on page 17, I think part of the warning signals do talk a little bit about what you're talking about. Does a regulatory action have a severe impact on the landlord's economic interest? If we basically kind of like make the change that says that the sunset does not, if we decide to basically retain the sunset clause, that the sunset does not cause a substantive depreciation in property value, in other words, case by case, and the proof has to be left on the owner, then they would be allowed to continue on forward with their existing use of that property. That could also be a wording. Am I wrong? Or?
Well, you can essentially put any wording you want in the code, but whatever comes out of this process and draft will at some point be in front of the prosecutor's office, and they will review those matters.
Okay.
And you're only passing a draft. You're not actually passing the ultimate code that's going to be adopted in its final form. It may be the goal is to have as close to a final product come out of a planning commission process as ultimately what the Board of Commissioners pass. But frequently the Board of Commissioners are looking at a particular code proposal through a lens that takes into account those things such as liability and other things that may not have been adequately fleshed out just simply because of the way the process works at the planning commission level. Meaning there's a second level of review for those types of things to make sure the county is not typically wanting to intentionally get crossways with something that's going to open them up to a clear indication of liability.
May I interpret that to saying that if we do go ahead and make certain passes to this, it will not be basically allowed to go through if, let's say, the county prosecutor determines that that particular clause would in fact be substantive, depreciation of property value?
Right. So the prosecutor's office is advisory only.
Right.
Not only for us, but for the Board of Commissioners. The Board of Commissioners as a legislative body have the authority to make whatever decision they wish, whether it's founded in law or not founded in law or supported in law. They're going to weigh heavily any decision based on the advice that they get from the prosecuting attorney's office, but that's not to say that they are formally bound by that advice from the prosecutor's office. They can make a decision that might differ with the analysis from the prosecutor's office. I'm not saying they do or will, but they're not required under the law the prosecutor is not the elected Board of Commission. So they can only provide suggestions, and then it's up to the Board of Commissioners whether they want to follow those suggestions or not.
Ryan, can I ask you where you got that document from?
It was some of the stuff that was sent out previously, and it was brought up. I've heard it a couple different times in the past and just following through.
Okay.
Thanks. I have a question. Has the Planning Commission, since I'm new, so I don't know if I've reviewed every single document that you folks have reviewed on this particular issue. Have you identified the public impacts and actually stated what the public impacts are of overnight rentals?
When you say public impact, Joe, can you give me an example to help focus?
Well, I would mean, I can easily understand there's noise. Some would say that there's the impact on residential development, housing costs, those types of things.
So Lisa might be able to remember some of that, at least at a high level, but there's not been any specific Chelan County analytics done.
Okay.
At any kind of a fine scale that would inform, we have this many noise complaints, and the noise complaints in areas with SDRs are different.
No, I wasn't thinking about specifically on this many noise complaints. I was thinking more so of the Planning Commission coming together in an agreement on a resolution that said, we need to address this issue because these are the public impacts that we want to address.
So that was the intent of the visioning statement of the county commissioners that was withdrawn, and you're not.
I saw that they did withdraw it. So my question was, has the Planning Commission actually stated anything?
So Jim, I could add here, the situation assessment that was done back in March does identify sort of the range of effects of short-term rentals in communities, and that was given to the Planning Commission in April. And there is a purpose statement in the draft code, it's the beginning paragraphs. That's a place where if you wanted to take a look at the rationale for the regulations, and you could certainly modify that if you like.
That should be on line 141 in the lined draft code document.
Thank you.
But I agree with you that other than having actual figures that have been analyzed, we do have facts that when the short-term rentals first began to appear along the shorelines of the different, Manson and up at Lake Wenatchee, what was happening is that the people were purchasing those properties for very high values, which increased the values of the properties around them. And then that ultimately increased the tax burden for the people around them. And in some cases, people had to sell because they could no longer afford to have their family cabin that they've had for all those years. That's one impact. Another impact is that it increases the property values countywide, which makes it very difficult to have the long-term rentals at a reasonable price, because anybody that's anybody is going to want to get more money if they can. And so not that the short-term rentals had a direct impact on that, but they do overall.
And just to add to that, Vicki, I just got the revaluation, and it was a year over year 75% increase in the value of mine. And then the treasurer said that it was because of the fact that there's been a lot of bidding wars in our area.
Mm-hmm. Well, on top of that, I think we have probably over 1,000 pages of comments from the public, of which, let's say, 50% of them are issues with vacation rentals. So I don't think there's a question that there are issues there that, that should be addressed. And I think our purpose statement that Lisa pointed out is as good as we're going to get and should be. And we should probably move on.
Okay.
Yeah. And for clarification, the reason I bring that up is in reviewing the AG's document there, what they did suggest is that as long as the government agency does identify the public good and the purpose for putting new regulations into place, that goes into defending whatever it is, those regulations that are in place or that will be put in place. So right. That's the reason I brought that.
Thank you, Joel. So I guess we got several different ways of taking this. We can take the hard stuff first, or we can take kind of the general stuff. As a body, you have a direction you would like to proceed with?
Did we finish talking about the district use charts?
No, that was probably one of the bigger ones that we were stuck on last time.
Okay. I recommend maybe we move on to other areas and then come back to that, because I think how we ultimately form the standards and the regulation will determine whether or not some of these places need to be sunsetted or not, basically.
Right. You guys, I don't know how to approach this exactly, but I really agree with a lot of the short-term rental people in that we do not want to keep adding on regulation after regulation after regulation. What we do have on the books as far as the noise and the garbage and the parking and so on is already on the books. So that's a behavioral thing. And so that's that. But what I think most importantly, what we're addressing is that short-term rentals are not compatible in neighborhoods. And so we need to figure out what we can do about that that's fair on both ends of the deal, because they were led to believe they could put them in there. I'm thinking that if I like the idea, this is just my overall thing. I like the idea that we're putting the 5% cap by county or by zip code on everything. But I would move that we increase the percentage, and you guys won't like this, I don't think, in RRR and RW to 10%, which is one in every 10 homes, because those are recreational areas and are designated as recreational areas. One in 10 is not overwhelming, but as far as the long run goes. And that in the all other residential zones, that the short-term rental cannot be sold as a short-term rental in the residential areas because it's not compatible. But if they can continue to be serviced as a short-term rental with the idea in mind that the regulations are going to be enforced, which we know that they will be in the future.
Jim, can you clarify what RW stands for, please? The
definition? Recreational waterfront.
Is it, or is it residential waterfront?
Well, residential waterfront, but it's still
rural waterfront.
Rural waterfront.
That's right.
Okay. So it says rural waterfront is what our code says here. Okay. So, but the rural village and all the others would be considered residential, and no short-term rentals can go in there. Okay, and I'm saying you can't build in there in the future either. Okay, and so therefore, through attrition, and I'm questioning whether we need to have a sunset or not. I know it's going to last over a long period of time, but we also need to make sure, knowing that they're going to be enforced, we need to also be fair to what they purchased it for. And I think by not allowing it to sell as a short-term rental, that's going to help to get the property values back in line with what they should be. Just like the tech stocks went way up in value, and then they had to have some evening out to bring it back to a level that's reasonable.
Can I just make a clarification on that, Vicki? There was a subsection in there where it discusses the fact that the 98826, which is the most affected zone, gets partialed out as well as individual zones. And if you look at, could you bring up that slide of that map, please, Jim? That's the map where you have 98826 parceled out into individual zones.
Right.
Lisa, you should be able to share your screen if you have that.
So you want to see the map that shows the areas where in the Lake Wenatchee area where things
are? Yeah, it would be a page 501, attachment B.
501, attachment C.
I just want Vicki to see that that there is an or in there. It basically says by zip code or by essentially these subsections. So it would be the previous attachment number. So that one right there.
Yeah.
Do you see that, Vicki?
Yes, I do.
So that's 98826, but the or says that it's either countywide, as area code wise, or as AK special attachment B, Leavenworth Lake Wenatchee sub area wise. So when mm-hmm. you say 10% is what you're talking about, you also mean these sub areas, which I believe if you actually look at Plain and Lake Wenatchee, you're probably closer to 25% right now, STR.
Right, right. And those cannot be sold. But see that not all of them. Oh, where's the maps that we got? The maps that show what the RRs are.
I'm referring to the stuff I sent you guys in the middle.
That's really good information.
That is also on the website, by the way.
Yeah, that was on the website. I don't think that was sent to us, Vicki.
Oh, it was on the website, but it was emailed to us.
Put it on the website.
Vicki, yes. You're speaking about the maps that show the short-term rentals on top of zoning. Is that what you're?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm talking about. But it's really hard on these maps unless you really blow them up. And I had printed them, and that's why I'm having difficulty being able to see what the deals are. But we need to make sure that somehow everything is, you know, we'd have to change the comprehensive plan in order to make sure that we have everything coded correctly. We do not want the short-term rentals in rural village, but I don't see anywhere on the map where rural village is even shown.
Rural village, I thought, was only in that one small lake area there near Lake Wenatchee. Fish Lake.
Yeah, we've got rural village in a few places around.
Wilson, I believe, is a Wilson Road and Shore are rural village developments.
Okay, but okay, that's where we do not want short-term rentals to be able to be sold or built.
Hey, Vicki?
Yes?
You were noting like RR10 and RW for that, correct?
Yes, except that we have to later on discuss level 3 of the short-term rentals.
Okay, I got one other question. How about like rural recreational
zoning? Well, rural recreational, the RRR, those two, rural waterfront and RRR, is where we could have the short-term rentals that are existing. However, what I want to say is that in the future, when short-term rentals are built, that we allow them to be built as a planned development, and not any closer than 500 feet of the nearest neighborhood. Okay, and that those developments will be allowed to have clubhouses, swimming pools, you know, things that the short-term rental village will be able to enjoy together. They can have their parties, they can enjoy, and it's not bothering neighbors.
So I have a question just on when you're going by the RRR or the zoning code, are you still going to have a size limit on the acreage? Because there's a lot of lots that are like within a 10-acre zoning area that are less than 10 acres. So would you still, would you put a limit on the size of the acreage that has to be in place?
Well, see, the RR 2010 2.55, we short-term rentals would not, the type 2 short-term rentals would not be allowed to be built on those because those are residential zones, including the rural village. Okay?
Okay.
But we've got to take a look at separately the type 3 short-term rental, which is the lodge, which would fit right in with an RR 10 or 20, provided that the land around it is actually the 10 acres or 5 acres, 10 acres, or 20 acres.
Yep, and that's it. That you answered my question.
Okay.
My concern right now is that what you're asking for is a substantial change from what we have right now. There's no way we would have that in the next 6 months, I don't think. It just sounds that way. So? Now, when you talked about basically increasing it from 5% to another percent, that's easy, right? That's an easy edit. But when you're talking about let's also make a change for the RW and make this for that, and it sounds substantial to me. And I don't know, I guess this has only passed once, I guess, and they brought it back to take out one particular thing. And now, I mean, I think it seems like the panel had plenty of opportunity to make these really substantial changes earlier. And it seems like I thought today we were just going to make some small changes and then pass them forward. And now to ask for a bunch of changes seems unfair to staff, actually, and then actually unfair to our the folks that we represent.
And I have to agree with you, Ed. I think this is too much right now. And once we get code in place, I think then we can start working on refining it.
I agree, Carl. We can
maybe refine. We need to go in that direction. I disagree wholeheartedly with the 10%, but I understand what you're saying, Vicki.
Okay. Okay. Now, I'm just trying to be fair on both sides, but I'm also wanting to address the fact that this was an issue and it has become a problem. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been, the county commissioners wouldn't have been receiving so many complaints. And I don't want us to poo-poo that and then put our Chelan County residents in a place where they have to put up with something that they, you know, whatever.
My main incentive to basically get this passed tonight so that we can get essentially enforcement in place. I think the main problem right now is that even the, I guess what they call the UGAs or whatever, they're complaining about the fact that the enforcement is almost strictly through a legal venue, which is right. costly and long and lengthy. And then that's just, you know, it's just horrible, right? But if we get essentially enforcement in place, we'll get a better idea of what the real problems are, because there'll be fines being assessed for whoever whoever will be passing out the enforcement. And so that's my incentive. My incentive is to give people a break, the folks that are in there that are trying to basically pass, especially like a Peshastin, right? Who have their own personal set, and it's only affecting like three people, but they can't get enforcement in place because it has to go through a legal process. And so my incentive to basically get this thing passed and on the books, and like Carl says, to make adjustments later, is to make sure that we have some sort of like enforcement in place so that the people can actually have something that they can go to where their peace of mind can be put in place.
Well, I would agree with the enforcement, but I would also suggest that there still needs to be a legal process once you have enforcement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Well, enforcement's probably, that's not even our issue. We're talking land use.
No, I know, but once you pass this, then it goes to the commissioners and then they establish enforcement.
Exactly. Okay.
Can we maybe go to starting, I think if we just put the percentage, first of all, and lock in on that, that seems to be a point, and whether it's the sub areas or across
I would
the
like
board,
to, Ryan, I would like to address something just prior to that, if I could. On line 152, we talk about a tier one, and I would like to see if we can't refine tier one a little bit.
What line was that again, please?
Line 151. Instead of 200 feet, I'd like to make that 50 feet. I think the point of 200 feet was to allow people that lived on adjacent lots to rent out a whole house, and they lived within 200 feet and they could call it tier one. And I think that's a bit of a loophole that should be closed, and we should make it 75 feet, something like that.
Is that measured? How is that measured by? Is it measured by building to building, or is it like property to property line?
It doesn't say how it's measured in our draft code.
It does say 200 feet of the owner's primary residence.
Staff comment.
And you could clarify that to be 200 feet of the parcel or whatever distance you're thinking about.
So, well, again, I would like it to read something like 50 or 75 feet to ensure that they are in fact owner occupied rentals.
So Carl, are you wanting that it's the
I have a comment that I'd like to
so
make
that the unit is actually on the parcel, or is it okay to have the parcel next door?
No, it should be on the parcel.
Okay.
Jim. Can I make a comment? Go ahead, Jim.
Just a point of consideration is that some of these that are operated are actually accessory dwellings on parcels with a primary dwelling, and either the accessory dwelling the property owner is living in or vice versa. But they're literally might be further than 200 feet apart, but it's because of parcel size, not because of being adjacent parcels. And where we have people who have one of the dwellings on the same parcel they are on is rented as an STR and they live in the other one.
And so it would be likely better to be from parcel to parcel distance versus residence to residence, so you don't have to go out and measure.
I suggest that to you from the standpoint of, otherwise, you could have a person that your intent was to have them live right there, and just because of the physical spacing between the two structures within the one parcel, you would be excluding them, when I don't think, my sense from what I'm hearing is that's not what you're trying to do.
And if I might, I believe this came in because of some testimony that some people own a house on the same street. They're just a door or two down. I believe that's where this came from, because I think Jim's correct that the code says the short-term rental needs to happen either in the primary residence or the accessory. So it wasn't the intent to measure on the same parcel itself. It was really, I think this came from trying to respond to a comment that it, in effect there is owner occupancy or there's close attention paid because it's basically on the same.
Well, you point, Lisa, to exactly what I'm hoping we get away from, and that is it can be 50 feet, it can be 200 feet, but the rental needs to be on the same parcel as the owner's primary residence.
That's interesting. So is 200 feet about six lots over?
No, it's about two.
Okay, two lots over. Depending, I guess, which dimension you're looking at.
Well, I would say that if tier one is owner occupied typically means that the owner is on the parcel that they own and the rental is on the parcel that they own.
Owner occupied. I agree with you, but I'm afraid if it doesn't say that, then it leads to some interpretation.
I think it's a good catch.
Well, it was intentional, I think, to respond to people's comments. If you want to just have it be on the owner's property, period, whether it's in the residence or the accessory unit, I would strike this. I wouldn't think that 50 or 75 feet make a difference, because really what we're talking about is if you only want it to be owner occupied on the same property and not make an allowance for something very close by, I would just strike that.
Any motions out there?
Well, before we go there, what I like about this is that it says the rental has to be within 200 feet of the owner's primary residence. So if we strike it completely, we want to make sure we don't have owners putting trailers up next to their home, renting their home and living in the trailer. That isn't acceptable either.
There's another paragraph later that says that the short-term rental has to be either in the primary residence or an accessory unit, but cannot be in a temporary dwelling like an RV.
You're right, but let me repeat what I said, because we have it right here in the Manson area, actually. The owner puts a trailer at his residence. The owner lives in the trailer while he rents his house.
I believe there's another spot in the code currently. I'm not sure exactly where it's at, but there's a limitation of how long a trailer can be on a piece of property, and it creates it as a temporary and not a permanent structure.
Yeah, there's actually, depending on the circumstances and the scenario and time, there's actually a potential code violation in the existing code for what Carl describes.
Well, if we just took this, we can leave it at 200 feet, but if we just added on the same parcel, I think it would ensure that we have what we intended it to be.
But yeah, my only concern there, Carl, is if it's a 5-acre lot, and at one end of the lot is the primary resident, and at the other end of the lot is a ADU, which could be over the 200 feet. I don't know if that's an issue, because that would be on full property.
Well, I don't know if it is either, but we want the whole point of this was to make sure that the owners are there so that if there's any issues, that the owner can respond to those quickly. If it's a 5-acre parcel and the rental's at one end and he's at the other, I'm not sure that they can respond as quickly as we would like them to, or respond at all.
I would prefer just to say the parcel itself.
Can we say the parcel itself and then put a maximum acreage on the parcel?
I think we could just leave it on the parcel itself.
I would concur.
Let's have a motion, Carl.
Okay, I don't know. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was frustrated because I didn't know if you could. Okay, so are we going to allow then for that same dwelling to be rented out, or a dwelling to be rented out for 15 days in a calendar period and be considered a type one or tier one? Are we going to keep that in?
Yeah, I would suggest we change nothing else, only item B on line 151.
So to delete item B.
No, I would, in fact, the motion should be that the short-term rental is located within the same parcel as the owner's primary residence.
I second it.
Discussion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any oppose? Motion carries.
Hey, good job.
A step forward.
Well, if we want to keep going, can I go to line 222?
Sure.
This is a bit parochial, but on line 222, this... just a background, this was a discussion or inserted to ensure that inside of the Manson urban growth area, that if they weren't registered, that they were not going to be allowed to continue as an existing short-term rental. And I'm wondering if instead of the, as of the effective date, we could put in the year 2020, since I'm hoping this will be done this year, and that would preclude a rush to register them in the next year.
And I'd like a clarification, please, on this particular topic, because I do have a comment on that on my piece of paper. Why wasn't the Peshastin UGA included in that?
You don't have a requirement for a permit in the Peshastin UGA.
They don't have a requirement.
Yeah. So 2020, is that December 31st, 2020, or January 1st, 2020?
I would leave it at 2020 because the existing code doesn't give a date for when they had to register. It only said they had to register for January 1st through December 31st.
I would still put in a month and day if you're going to do that. I'd put in 12/31/2020. And that just makes it clear that that's the bookend date.
Well, if that's the case, I would say December 31st of 2020.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Any other discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Carl.
If I could ring in on one, and I think it's actually mentioned in one of the handouts that was sent out about the number and density. We talked a lot about this, and I think there was general agreement on it. So we just basically solidify it about changing or taking out the word countywide from lines 170 to 177. I think this would be in line 172. Do we have that on the screen? There we go. Yeah. Total housing stock, countywide, zip codes, urban growth areas, or the Leavenworth Lake Wenatchee overlay, which is what I was talking about earlier, or any sub area. Now, the only thing about it is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lisa, you're using the word or in here. Can we basically assume that the or means that any one of those don't fit, then basically it falls under the 5% category?
So the intent was that if it's greater than 5% in a zip code or a UGA or the Leavenworth Lake Wenatchee overlay, the reason for the, or any sub area within the overlay, so that if for some reason the overall zip code made it down below 5%, that some of those sub areas, like let's say around Lake Wenatchee, if those were still above 5% just around Lake Wenatchee, you wouldn't put a new short-term rental there. But if elsewhere in the zip code it got down below 5%, you could potentially put a new one.
Interesting, but I think the reason we want to take out countywide is because right now it's over 5% countywide, so it basically it masks everything underneath it as
That's
all.
That's correct.
Is that right?
Yeah. It's okay,
so I would like to make a motion that we basically strike countywide from line 172 of the codes.
Second.
Discussion?
What exactly does that do? I lost a thread.
It makes it look, so what we're looking at is individual zip codes rather than countywide for the 5%. So within 98826, and then there's sub areas within 98826, which is the Lake Wenatchee area or whatever we had decided on. So that even if 98826 gets 5%, but Lake Wenatchee still has 16% short-term rental ratio, then they cannot build new short-term rentals there. It has to be outside of that area. Does that make sense?
I think so. Yeah. Thank you.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries.
I would like to ask Lisa on line 223 to help me to understand this and make sure I understand it correctly. If an existing rental is non-conforming because they don't meet the standards, the way I read this, then they cannot continue to be a short-term vacation rental. The only non-conforming units would be if they meet all the standards, but they happen to be in a zone that's restricted. Do I understand that correctly?
Right, that paragraph sub two here. If there's a zone that does not allow a short-term rental as of the date this is passed, then only those short-term rentals that exist and are compliant with the rest of the criteria can stay. Otherwise, that unit, if it's prohibited, they would have to cease after 2 years. So I believe, for example, there's some zones in like the Peshastin UGA where the use table shows it as prohibited. So if there was one in there, they'd have to cease after 2 years.
Thank you.
Do we have any other items amongst the...
But in anywhere, can I ask based on, keep going on that one, but are there any areas that we have restricted short-term rentals from not being able to go in at all other than the commercial...
Other than the commercial what?
The commercial ag or commercial industrial or commercial forestry or whatever. Are we restricting them in any other area?
Countywide in the rural area, it's restricted in rural industrial and rural public. I'm not sure that there are any in there. And then in the Peshastin UGA, they're restricted in the residential zones and only allowed in the commercial zones. And then the Manson UGA, there are some tier three that would be prohibited in some of the zones.
Okay.
And you also have the issue of the sunsetting, which I'm not trying to get us on that rabbit trail yet. You guys are making progress, but when you go back to the original district use chart on 90, That's where you get into the P1s with the three and the CUPs with the three. And those are the ones that have a sunset. So those boxes will turn white in that area once those sunsets have occurred, if you retain that in the code.
But I thought we basically clarified that and said that it did not turn white. It actually turned, reverted back to P1. I thought we were very clear on that. That's why I wanted to have clarification at the very beginning of the meeting.
Well, and Jim, I think that since it's saying on lots 2.5 acres or smaller, you would sunset. So there may be some lots that are larger than 2.5 acres in some of these areas. Yeah. So I don't think they would completely go blank unless for some reason in the zone there are no lots greater than 2.5 acres.
That's a fair point. You're correct.
So in line with that, the Manson Community Council has indicated to me that they have found some in this area here in Manson and in the UGA where there's more than one rental on a given parcel. So I looked at line 235, which established the standards, and I guess I'm asking Lisa or Jim or anyone else, if someone had two dwellings on one parcel, can they rent them separately based on the existing code, the existing draft?
Well, I thought the intent was that they had to be in one or the other. They have to be in an accessory unit or in the primary unit.
Are you saying any rental, or are you saying as a tier one or as a tier two? What specifically are you asking, Carl?
Well, I want to know if based on this draft code, if we would allow two vacation rentals in one parcel, say an accessory dwelling and a main residence, and then if the answer to that is yes, are they going to be licensed or permitted separately or together?
On a P1, you couldn't, because on a P1, you'd only have potentially an accessory dwelling unit and the main residence, and you have to live in one, so that by default, you wouldn't be able to get more on for a P1, but potentially like in a three, you could.
A tier one or a tier three is what you mean.
Yeah.
Got that.
Wouldn't they then convert over to a, essentially either a hotel, or wouldn't they convert over essentially to a bed and breakfast?
No, bed and breakfast requires, under the current code, requires the owner-occupant.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking tier one, so it is owner-occupied.
Go ahead.
What do you think about, I think the way this was written originally was you would have it in one or the other, and the main goal was that it be in a permanent dwelling. I wonder if we want to add a sentence that says, if there's more than one structure rented, then it is considered a tier three or a tier two or something like that. It wouldn't be a tier one, as was pointed out.
I think maybe suggest a cleaner way to deal with that is say, if more than one structure is rented on the same parcel and is not owner occupied, then it is treated as a separate rental unit. That way you don't have a question of like five of these on one parcel all rented under one, when they're actually separate, disconnected structures completely operating independently of one another.
I suppose we could add only one rental unit is allowed per parcel.
Mm-hmm. I think that's cleaner, and I think, in my mind, it seems like it wouldn't even be allowed to have two homes on one parcel unless one was an accessory dwelling.
I agree, Vicky.
I got an odd question to that. Could that potentially cause any problems in the agricultural world with any farm worker housing and how they choose to rent or provide that housing to those individuals?
No, because they're covered under something else. They're regulated through a state agency. Is that right?
There's state law that regulates what constitutes farm worker housing and the standards connected to that and all of that. So I think that would trump what we have in a county code.
And I believe, Jim, it's also treated separately on your use chart anyway.
Seem to remember reading it there.
Not to throw another wrench in there, we have some here in the Manson UGA that are they're basically apartments. They're one building with four units in it, and I don't think we want to eliminate three of the four units, so I'm not sure how we would handle that. What I'm trying to get to is where there's two separate buildings, completely separate, and they're both
detached
STRs. And they either have to have individual licenses or only one can be rented. I'm not sure which.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking detached structures.
Yes. Thank you. Detached structures.
If a purchaser bought a place that had a primary residence and a accessory dwelling on it with the intent of using it as essentially each one of them as a tier two STR, they would have to be individually permitted. Just for sake of a real world example that you could find in this county. So
okay.
You could simply say that all individual units, whatever we're going to refer to them, all tier twos, regardless of whether they're on one parcel or multiple parcels, they have to be registered individually or something to that effect. Because isn't that what you're trying to get at?
Exactly, yes. And there's also places here in the Manson area that have, excuse me, an upstairs and a downstairs, and they're rented completely separately, managed completely separately, but they're in one house.
Hmm. Interesting.
I was going to take a quick look at the definition of short-term rental because I think this started with using a residential home, right? So let's see here. A dwelling unit or a portion of it that's offered. Okay.
So it's singular, huh?
I think, Jim, if I were trying to respond to this, it seems like first you would figure out, does your base code allow for, you know, how many dwelling units can you have on a property in a zone, right? If your zone allows for a single, you know, one home per
parcel,
it seems like you would expect one short-term rental. And if you had more than one dwelling unit on a property, like a primary and accessory, I agree you would want to permit each of those. But once you get past a primary and an accessory, it seems like you'd be exceeding the number of dwellings that you would normally have on a property, and you'd be in sort of a different ball game as a tourist accommodation. If you want to try to allow them through short-term rentals, it seems to me once you get past a primary and accessory, you'd be definitely in a lodge type setting and either going through a tier three or some kind of, or assuming that they need to go get it.
Are you saying that that's built into the code, or are you saying we should put that wording in?
No, we already have that. That's what she's referring to is lodging facilities, which are contained in the existing code. And that is typically six or more individual units delineated with individual numbers, obviously on the same parcel. So whether that's one big 12-room bedroom building or whether that's a series of cabins, the existing code for lodging facilities is fairly broad in the definition.
So bed and breakfast is up to 3 rooms, owner occupied. Guest house is up to 6 rooms. Somehow, Jim, I'm just trying to relate this to back to other use allowances. At some point, somebody would be beyond what I think the intent of the residential zone would be. So I think we need to match it to at least how you allow other uses in a residential zone.
Correct.
So I think we need to make some adjustments in the language, but I think we need some clarity. I think Carl's examples are great to hear because I think we need to clarify how you would address 2 units on a site that are, or what, you know, sounds like almost a guest inn, Carl. You know, if there's
more. I think Jim kind of had the right idea. And line 332 under land use permits, if we could make sure that we had language in there that basically said, I'm trying to come up with it, but each individual unit rented must have their own land use permit.
Land use permit?
So what you're saying is under 4 land use permits, 332, we would add language in like A, or even add an additional C between B and C or something that said each individual, what short-term?
Would these not just be tied to per parcel, not individual? Because land use, you can do the whole parcel, not just piece of a parcel.
Well, you could say all dwelling units, you could add a line that said all dwelling units on the same parcel that are used as a short-term rental shall be covered under a permit.
Shall be reviewed together? Is that what you said?
No, I'm giving a little deference here to what Ryan said. What I'm trying to get at is that it just recognizes that they need to be reviewed in the same application
concurrently.
Process. Yeah.
So if the land use permit is issued to the parcel and they want to have 3 units or 4 units, whatever is on there, it would just be that the single parcel has to identify all short-term rentals and use permits on that property as part of the parcel, correct? As part of the land use permit. Is that correct?
Yes, I guess one of the things I'm thinking of from an application, when I say application, I mean us applying the code, is, you know, we frequently see changes to things. People do changes midstream, mid-year, whatever. And so I think when you look at a application process and you're considering all the external factors that go into determining if there's going to be any conditions connected to the use, that if somebody all of a sudden says, hey, you know what, we got another one on the parcel that we just booted a long-term renter out of and we're going to start renting it too, that they've essentially got to go back through that application process with all of them so that we can look at it holistically and see if adding the one additional somehow affects the conditions that were applied to the other 2 that might be on the same parcel or the other one, that it's not viewed in isolation.
I would agree with that, and I've seen that in action, where there's a 3-room. Well, we've had 3-room B&Bs, and then they want to expand, or want to add a different ADU to that, and the whole application has to be reviewed once again. So that makes good sense.
Yeah, and Catherine was just making the comment behind me here that it also might push it into a different category.
Yes.
You might wind up with more heads. You might now be a lodging facility. You might be, but it should be subject to reapplication if you're going to be changing by adding or whatever you're doing with regard to expanding.
Okay. Well, I think I can live with that. I understand.
Any other items out there? Anyone else?
Just to go through.
I'm going to hog the time, I guess I am. Line 241, please.
Did you want to add this language that we just worked through here?
Is there a motion?
Oh, sorry.
Well, I don't think it's each individual unit rented must have its have their own land use permit.
It's the parcel itself.
The idea is if mid-year after you've registered this thing, you decide you're going to take the accessory dwelling and add it to it. We don't just look at the accessory dwelling individually. You basically have to reapply and we reevaluate the entire parcel to see what the implications are of adding an additional accessory dwelling or some other, you know, again, maybe they were living in it originally and now they're moving out, they're gonna rent it and they wanna have it covered under it. That's not the original application. We need to revisit the issue.
Well, then this is set up right. Is that right?
I think so. I like the language that's there and I move that we accept that language as written.
I second it.
A first from Carl, a second from Vicky.
Could I have a reread, please, of how it's going to look like in the final ending? Just starting in at the very beginning of 335, please.
I think the way she has it written, right?
Yeah, all dwelling units on a single parcel shall be reviewed concurrently in the same application.
Oh, that's new. I'm sorry. The green part is new.
Okay. Yeah.
I see. I thought you were pointing to the right-hand side there where it says Lisa.
I've been taking notes as the conversation progresses and when it looks...
All dwelling units a single... Okay, great. Thank you.
Solid, we put it in.
Any other comments? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Okay. Carl, can I talk about something? It's the code sections area again, because we're in that section I. Section I, starting in line 392. So just basically throw out some scenarios and see how you guys see this fitting in. So a person, the area is below 5%. Let's say you're in Wenatchee and you have a house, it's 0.6% there and it's been STR. And now you want to sell it. And one of the things that you want to talk about is the fact that, oh, look, it's an STR. But because of this limitation, it regardless of what standing the zip code has, it says that you can only have one transfer of ownership for an STR. And then after that, they have 3 years to sell it to the non-STR. But if they go and they buy a new house, right? Or they buy a house that has not been an STR before, and then they apply for an STR, all of a sudden that house is allowed to be an STR. Am I interpreting the draconian wording in this particular paragraph?
I think the 5% will limit whether they can turn a new house into an STR.
Right, that's true. I've stated that, but I'm guessing if it's already an STR and you're way below the 5%, this base wording here says that they can no longer continue to make that house an STR once ownership transfers, even though you're below the 5%.
You can sell it one time and there's no distinction as to whether you're in an area that's
exactly
got a higher than 5% or a less than 5%.
That's right. It seems a bit draconian. That's
I think at the end of the 3 years, if they're still below 5%, they can apply and should receive the permit.
Is that what it says?
No, it's a first come, first serve basis, I think.
Yeah, it doesn't say that, Carl. I guess it's what I'm trying to say. So if we could put some wording in there, they should reapply. instead of basically so like that's it, it's over.
Well, I thought this part of the reason this was in here when we went through drafting a few months ago was an effort to help start that downward trajectory in overall numbers. And so my recollection was that the idea on the limit of transfer was you can continue to operate as a short-term rental, but when you sell it, that's where that starts to go away. So it starts reducing the numbers overall. That was my recollection.
You're right, but I think that the matrix has changed a little bit since we took out countywide.
What would you recommend for language?
I would just say basically go through the permitting process again, even after a sale. And then basically all the things that we're talking about right here would come into play.
Mm-hmm. So you're suggesting to just strike that section?
I don't know. Is that what it would happen?
That's what it looks like.
You would have to add at the end of 3 years, they would have to apply as a new STR.
Yeah, that's a good one, Carl. I like that.
So we are totally in favor of them being able to sell as an STR one time.
If it's below, like in Wenatchee, we were talking about, Wenatchee is a 0.6% STR ratio. And so...
0.5, okay.
So what I'm hearing is if the area is below 5%, you can have more than one transfer. If you're in an area that is over 5%, you could check back again in 3 years. Is that what I heard?
Yeah, like anybody else.
I would think you could just go back at any point in time. The number drops and wouldn't be a time sensitive.
My preference, honestly, is that anytime there's a transfer of ownership, you have to reapply for an STR.
And it's not guaranteed that you're going to get the permit.
That's exactly right.
But that would be difficult for a lot of these of how they transfer and sell based upon how they're set up currently. So your likelihood of a sell will have dynamics in the real estate world.
Also, doesn't the land use permit run with the land?
It does.
But there's a requirement to annually reapply, and if you stop using it as an STR, then basically it goes away. If you stop using it for more than a year. So this could be written so that there's sort of two pathways. If you're in an area less than 5%, you can have more than one transfer. If you're in an area greater than 5%, then the paragraph that's there would apply.
As a real estate person, I think that would be a very lucrative wording, I think. Maybe make that particular commodity more valuable.
Well, and another way, there's an alternate path to get there, and that would be make a reference to the transfer that simply refers you back to the provisions contained in 1188-280 subsection 2, which is on line 148. Excuse me, that's not the right one, but basically it takes you back to the percentage issue. You could reference back to that so that as long as you're within the parameters that are contained within our 5%, 1% and all that, then you can reapply. The new owner could reapply. If not, it's prohibited, and it's prohibited like every other existing property that's not an STR. It confers no continuing rights under the new ownership, and it can't reapply. The new owner can't reapply until the area-wide restriction has been met.
So in other words, it cannot be sold as a short-term rental. It can be sold as a regular house, and then that person that purchased the house can apply to turn it into a short-term rental.
consistent with the restrictions contained in the percentage section of the code that we have.
Exactly.
So in other words, if you're in an area like Malaga and it sells, you don't automatically have a right to have an STR. You have a right to apply under this code if, as adopted, it wasn't a countywide cap. But in a place like Lake Wenatchee, you don't have a right to have it continue on as the new owner, but you can apply once that area has hit the target through attrition.
Good. Okay.
That's why I was suggesting referring back to the other portion of the code seemed to be the cleanest way to get us there. I don't know if Lisa can do that.
Does this not conflict, though, in a bit with some of that stuff we talked about earlier that I brought up with that RCW where, you know, if a property has a value and you're doing something to it that reduces its value, so if it has a value of whatever as the current STR and then you go to sell it and no longer has that value to that person, you've taken valuation away from that particular owner of what which they built up and established.
If it ends up not having any value,
it goes both ways.
I think that's a legal matter, a point of law that is something that we would have to take up with the prosecutor's office during further code review with the drafting with the Board of Commissioners, but I don't think that's a foregone conclusion. We run into this issue with regard to zone changes all the time, the change use where a person maybe wanted to have a business, a commercial business at a location. They bought it with that intent, but they didn't have a vested right for it. And before they were able to get their resources together and start the commercial business, the zoning changes.
And but in this case, you already have the resource that's being used where in that case, it hasn't been built up yet.
But I don't think there's case law that says that can't be done this way because they still have the value of this as
dwelling.
A single family residence.
Or as a rental.
Or as a long-term rental, exactly.
Right. Or they can move into it.
So I'm not sure if this does what we were talking about, but the language I've stricken is about the single transfer. So now what it would read is it would describe when a transfer occurs that the permit would automatically expire on sale or transfer or 3 years, whichever comes first. And then the operator must obtain a new permit application and new owners must apply for a new permit. That's regardless of whether, if you're in an area that's exceeding 5%, you wouldn't be able to meet the standards. But if you're in an area that it is lower than that, this is just saying this is non-transferable. That's with these changes, I think that's what this is doing.
Good.
If that's your intent, I think that's what this will do.
It's a little more relaxing, I think, Ryan, in terms of what it was there before.
I move we accept that language.
Well, first off, is it kind of confusing to say a transfer occurs when the property is sold to a person or when offers are changed or removed, all permits shall include the following provisions. Permits shall automatically expire upon sale. Okay, at just the beginning of it led it to believe that there's a transfer that's taking place, not the property being sold. It's like a double statement.
I think you would say if a transfer occurs where or when the property is sold to a person or, so if you said if, in front of there, then I think that would clarify because it does feel like you're starting up partway through a thought, which as it was originally written, that's what was going on.
And we had the language about the officers because some of them are held by LLCs.
Right.
That was covered.
So you would say if.
I was wondering about that. Thank you, Carl. Yeah,
so I wondered, Jim, if it's just
of ownership. So we need to put the word ownership back in, because we described that in the first sentence and then when that was fully struck. So if a transfer of ownership occurs where the property, not when, where the property is sold, then
sold to a person or when officers or corporation are changed to remove former officers.
I think, yeah, I think the main thing is the statement would be, before it was saying one transfer of ownership is allowed. Now it's saying there is no transfer of ownership. No transfer of ownership is allowed. I mean, that's what would be happening here.
Yeah, you're right.
The permit does not transfer when sold.
Well, if I could clarify, the intent was basically to subdue this paragraph a little bit. And then remember that originally the paragraph stated that you had to transfer, you basically will lose it as an STR. This wording right here allows you to go through a permit process again. And if you're in within the zones, then you'll be okay. You don't have to take it off of STR. I just want to make sure that's really why we went down this avenue.
I appreciate putting in there a short-term rental permit. That clarifies it.
So, see if this works.
I like that.
A short-term rental permit shall not transfer. New owners may apply for a short-term rental permit. A transfer occurs when
property is sold, change.
You still have the 3 years sitting in there.
And I think you have to add in, new owners may apply for a short-term rental permit pursuant to the to this code, so that it doesn't assume that you automatically have a right to somehow supersede the other provisions of the code.
To the provisions of this code.
Correct, to the provisions of this code.
So a short-term rental permit shall not transfer. New owners may apply for a short-term rental permit pursuant to this code.
No, pursuant to the provisions of this code.
Okay, and then it says when a transfer occurs.
Or a transfer occurs.
All permits shall include the following provision. This permit shall automatically expire upon sale or transfer of the property. And it would take out the 3 years per what Carl just mentioned.
I didn't want to create a standalone guarantee of right to apply that was somehow a super right above everybody else in the property ownership.
Carl, you had made a motion previously.
Yeah. I'm just reading through this again. Well, yeah, I move that we accept the language as written.
I would like to second it.
The first by Carl, a second by Ed. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes.
Can I beg to go to line 241? I would like to just tighten this up a little bit in adding that the total number of bedrooms cannot exceed what the building permit and if on an on-site sewage system, septic permit granted for the structure.
A building permit doesn't determine the number of people or the occupancy.
But it does determine the number of bedrooms, does it not?
Mm-hmm. You can have bedrooms, but not a number of them.
The health district won't issue a septic permit above the prescribed number of bedrooms that the septic design or the drain field will support. So in other words, you can't get a building permit issued by this department for a 7-bedroom home if the septic system on the property was only approved by the health district for a 3-bedroom home.
Does the bedroom imply the number of people though?
It seems yes.
In our code, it does.
Don't go to the bathroom, people do.
We say 2 guests per bedroom.
Okay, okay.
What I'm trying to ensure is that a 2-bedroom home doesn't suddenly become a 5-bedroom home when it was never permitted for that because they've changed some closets around or whatever, and particularly a 2-bedroom drain field doesn't suddenly become a 5-bedroom home.
So the language that Lisa just added at line 249 there, I think gets at what you're trying to get at, Carl.
Mm-hmm.
It is binding on the building permit for the house.
Isn't part of like Peshaston and maybe a couple other areas have sewer attached?
Shaston.
That's why
they could affect that.
System. It can be septic or sewer.
Well, so septic is a design criteria, whereas sewer, there's no design criteria for that. You're just connected to the sewer.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So there would be no bedroom. You could convert a room to a bedroom by adding a closet or...
That's correct.
...bring space.
You could, but wasn't the earlier discussion with the earlier makeup of the commission, planning commission, the concern was not exceeding the capacity of the septic system. So we could make it specific if on a septic system,
mm-hmm.
the number of bedrooms.
Yeah, I think that's, if I understand Carl correct, that's Carl's concern.
That's the biggest concern, yes.
Yeah.
So is on-site sewage system correct, or should we say on-site septic system?
Sewage.
I think it's normally the health district calls it an on-site sewage system.
Okay.
And by being on-site, it presumes it's not hooked to a pipeline leading away from the parcel.
Yeah, I think that would do well, and I would like to move that be included.
I'll second.
We got a first by Carl and a second by Joel. Any further discussion?
Nope.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
I have one more thing to add, and that is line 371. This is going to be potentially a long discussion point, but I would like to drop the Chelan Douglas Health District from there. On line 371.
It's
and,
now 374.
374.
Because we made other adjustments. So
oh,
this one.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. 374. Yep. And what I'd like it to say, and I'll just read what I kind of drafted here was, each permitted short-term vacation rental on a permitted on-site sewage system must have the system inspected and certified each year. This will be completed by a licensed and trained inspector on forms developed by the director and will be completed each year between May to September inclusive. And I propose this because, first of all, it takes the health district out of it so that they... we're not relying upon them to do this. And second of all, especially on rural waterfront, we really need to make sure that these septic systems are working the way they're intended to and that the effluent isn't going into the lake. I don't think this would be any additional burden to a short-term vacation rental owner. And in fact, would probably increase business opportunities for some people that want to get into this business.
Carl, I couldn't type fast enough, I don't think, here.
I'm sorry, but well, I opened it up for discussion, but I can read it to you again.
Well, is this something that one question came up to me this week, and it is this something that is required with all dwellings, or is it just the short-term rental, and is that fair?
It would be for short-term rentals, and I would argue that short-term vacation rentals are not the same as a regular residential home when it comes to on-site septic systems. A regular residential home is used in the same manner throughout the year without being inundated at any given time, unless you maybe have a Christmas party or a big party at Thanksgiving or a wedding or something like that. Vacation rentals tend to have a lot more people at them, and they're have a lot of effluent and a lot of wastewater going out in a short period of time. So from my discussions with tower design, which many of you may know, it would be really important to make sure these systems are working the way they're intended to. It is not a big demand upon owners, and it certainly wouldn't limit them. It would only ensure that the on-site septic systems or sewage systems are working properly.
Thank you very much. That was a good explanation.
Carl, just as kind of a clarification to it. So being that the units themselves are designed for said number of bedrooms just as a normal household, are you still feeling that more people will be there or showing up during X amount of time?
It won't be necessarily more people, but it will be at least in the Manson area. I think the Leavenworth area might be a little different, but in the Manson area, from June to September or May to September, it's used. They're used constantly and hard. And as Zach Towers said, he likes this because that's their retirement money. It's all the money they put in, they get from dealing with failed systems, and it all happens when they're being used hard during those months. I just think that it's not an out of bounds request to say that the vacation rentals should have their septic systems checked once a year.
What about just simply requiring with the application, the annual application, proof that within the preceding 3 months, the septic system has been pumped and inspected, and just put that in there, and then that forces an annual pump down of the tanks, which is going to help prevent, you know, an overflow or a failure situation. I mean, you could make it more than inspection and make it an annual clean out requirement, and then that's going to be preventative in itself.
Doesn't that seem like a little excessive annually pumping? Because in a lot of those systems, you don't want to pump them dry because you want the bacteria and stuff to keep generating. And if you're doing it every year.
I think he's saying that it's not necessarily pumped, Ryan.
I thought he was saying that it was being pumped every year.
Well, that was just saying it's been serviced.
Yeah, the concern is I'm not sure how, I mean, I have a septic system and I've lived there 20 years and I've had service done on it. You know, they just pop the lids and they look at it, and if everything looks okay, they don't do a bore scope down the drain field and all the other things that might be a telltale sign of a problem. So I'm not sure, we're assuming an outcome that I'm not sure we can write language in that's going to take into account what you're trying to get at.
So can we just say that it's service? I like the idea of just including it with your annual permit And mm-hmm. I would suggest that we just put in service then inspected and leave it up to the inspector.
Make the call on what's needed.
That's correct.
Yeah, that would probably do it. I don't think it needs to be pumped every year, although many of the vacation rentals do because their drain field has failed. But I just want to make sure that in the end, especially on the rural waterfront, we don't have effluent going into our lake. Because then it's going to ruin it for all the other vacation rentals.
Yeah, I still drink water from the lake. So,
are you talking Lake Wenatchee?
Yeah.
Yeah. Up at Chelan, we used to weigh up lake also.
You don't do that anymore in Chelan?
My parents sold the cabin.
So, what could we say that where was it? Where were we? 374?
Lisa's got some draft track changes on there.
Yes, she does. Okay.
Our time is running short again here.
Can we go a little over just to get this taken care of?
I could do that.
I would suggest you assign a limit.
15 minutes.
Oh, my.
Okay. So it would read, each applicant for a short-term rental shall provide documentation indicating the on-site sewage system has been properly serviced in the prior year. The applicant shall also ensure that there is a verifiable legal source of water that meets applicable standards.
I would like to add, for properly serviced, I'd like to add the word either inspected or certified.
Who's going to be qualified to certify or inspect?
Yeah.
Can the pumping service do it? Do we have to have an engineer? Who does that?
I would say that the director of community development would determine that in coordination with the health district.
What? Okay.
Most of the guys that pump it could probably do it for you.
Yeah. And provide
I would agree on the septic system. I think, you know, there the pump system, the pumper can do that. You can do the job. Right. That's just kind of their routine job. They give the condition of the septic system as part of the report as a maintenance.
I think the wording you have up there will work for us. We make similar references in the code all the time, and it's the director's discretion to determine what constitutes a qualified person.
Yep, and I think that's good. Well, I could I move that we accept the language as written.
Second.
So we got a first by Carl, a second by Joel. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Well, that didn't take that long.
I think we're down to one big item left, though. Back to the zoning.
Just a point of order, Chair.
Sure.
Didn't we vote on this already?
We voted on something a version of a proposal was voted down, but we have not voted on approving.
This line, P3, I think that was voted down, right? So what's the new proposal if it's not the same thing?
I don't know, but we've discussed many various items. Here. Vicki brought up some at the beginning of the meeting.
So Lisa, would this be an appropriate place for you to put up your brief presentation and just kind of blow through that highlight some, I'm trying to recall because my brain is kind of in a different place on this now in the code. Did your presentation attend to the table that we're at right now?
Yes.
I think generally what we were hearing at your last meeting was you wanted some more information on alternative ways to address the number of short-term rentals that may not rely on the use chart. So I think that's where this was coming from. Which you've taken care of the countywide reference. You've already done that. There was also a question about, is there another way to handle density through separation requirements? There were some options that you addressed about whether you wanted to remove the three-year sunset clause and then consider whether you wanted a P or a CUP, or you've discussed an administrative CUP, which would mean it didn't need to go to the hearing examiner. It would be less expensive and, or maybe not less expensive necessarily, but less process.
Lisa, just a point of clarification, it's a five-year sunset clause.
Yeah, in the wording, where we just were, it said 5 years.
Oh, excuse me, you're right. 5 years. What I understood was you were discussing whether or not to remove this, and we'll say 5 year sunset clause, and then consider whether you wanted to put a different permit type in the cell. And I think we discussed that the cell wouldn't go blank necessarily if you did have a 5 year sunset. What I was also hearing last time was, in lieu of the sunset clause, if there were tightening up of other standards like the transfer of sale or the septic systems, that might give you more confidence in removing the sunset clause. That's what we heard, I think, at your last meeting. So what
the idea behind this is to basically somehow incentivize attrition or forced attrition so that we could get down to some zones that are 25% down to 5%.
That was kind of the idea, but you, Lisa, you provided a comparison of different communities and stuff that put things together. You put a chart together.
Yep.
And there's, under the like sunset one, there's only one jurisdiction that does any sunsetting, and that's Cannon Beach. All of the other 10, there is no sunsetting that's occurring within the other jurisdictions.
Well, Bend and Newport have sunsetting, but I think that just points to the fact that it's not a takings clause on a national level, on a constitutional level.
So I think the Cannon Beach had a sunset and Ventura County has a sunset. Okanagan had one and removed it. I think the cap or distance is where Bend has a distance requirement. Newport has a distance requirement. Well, actually what they have is, rather, they have a cap. They have a total number you can have in the city. So what we were seeing is there's not as many that have a sunset clause, certainly none that we're aware of in Washington after Okanagan removed their sunset.
Want to point out that takings is a constitutional Fourth Amendment, so it's not just strictly a Washington thing. So if it applies, let's say, for example, in Bend and in Ventura, then it would apply here as well. And I think as it was stated before, you know, if we really are concerned on a legal perspective, we need to basically pass this on to legal counsel to see if there is really a concern that this is a legal insert or not.
I'm one for property rights in all cases, and I have a hard time with that.
With the sunset?
I just do. I understand the purposing behind it and stuff, and you know, I'm very much one that's people have rights to property. They buy it, and I know you got neighbors, and I deal with this daily in what I do for a living.
Right.
So I guess we're also being in without the sunset clause. We know that SDRs will not be available to sell going forward. Is that right, Ryan?
That's where we're at currently.
Yeah, and we said that you can't basically transfer that right. You have to go to reapply. I think that's reasonable and sensible, right?
That's reasonable and sensible.
I think the thing here is how do we, not sure how we got here, but how do we get to a point?
Well, the sunset clause, I believe, was some previous language that we were told to remove from our ears is where I believe it came from.
Is that right? Lisa, it was.
We can't refer to the prior, so.
Yeah.
I would suggest you strike that discussion as to whether it was or wasn't in the direction that you were given before. You can't even consider that.
I see.
But we did get some information through some of the mailings we received about if we are not going to use a sunset clause, even at a five-year sunset, we're talking a long, long period of time before we get down to that 5%, which is workable. But that's what the purpose of the sunset was to hurry along the process.
Yeah.
We have the guarantee that we are going to have better enforcement. And that's not a consideration we should take, but it is important. And that we should probably wait and see how things turn out, because they can always add a sunset at another time if that's necessary. But we further restricted, you can't sell it as a short-term rental. They have to reapply if it's within the under the 5%. And we've done another set of restrictions too. And so I feel comfortable with taking the sunset off.
So, okay, everybody has changed their mind. I think we should just put it up for a motion so that we can vote on the overall packet as a whole within the 15 minutes that we have. I think that all of us are learned in this particular area. I think we all have educated ourselves, and we all know, but I think that we need to hear a motion personally.
You can make one, Ed.
No, I'm not. I'm basically for keeping this in. It's Ryan or Vicky or you know.
I'm the chair, so I'm.
Oh, I see.
Count.
I'm out.
Well, I was trying to be fair, is why I made my comment. I thought everybody was going that route. You know what I'd like to see it say is on lots 2.5 acres or smaller, except in RW and RRR, short-term rentals shall sunset within a five-year period, effective such and such a date.
But earlier, weren't you in RRR as part of like RWs and R10s, Vicky?
No, RRR and RW are the two, recreational waterfront or residential waterfront and recreational.
Just to basically be clear, Vicky, RRR is not included in the sunset. I mean,
I would suggest if you want to change a status, we do it in the district use chart itself.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
The only thing I wanted to say is that in the if we sunset the RW below 2.5 acres, there will be no short-term vacation rentals on RW.
And what I'm saying is those are the exceptions. Don't sunset RW or RRR, but sunset anything else that's below 2.5 acres.
So basically where it is except for RW.
Right, RRR doesn't have the limitation. So okay. Right now RW does.
Bring it up for a motion, Vicki.
So moved.
So what is your motion?
I need to hear the motion.
Okay. On lots 2.5 acres or smaller, the short-term rental shall sunset within 5 years of whatever the date is we choose.
Is there an exception?
Okay, go ahead.
No, is there an exception?
Well, I thought Lisa said we shouldn't do the exception up there. We should do it down here on the district use chart.
Well, Vicki, can I suggest that that the motion read that we remove the sunsetting provision on RW on the district use chart, line 90.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, that's exactly what needs to be said.
But it's still subject to the 5%, so yeah. That's good.
So is that Carl's motion then?
That could be Vicki's motion.
Yeah, that was my motion.
All right.
Carl will second it.
Carl seconds it. Any discussion?
Yes, I'd like to see the chart regarding the percentages associated with the short-term rentals currently and see if it's going to have an impact, please. So we're saying that 14% will go away under the 2.5. Is that right? But the 22% will remain there for 35 years.
Wow.
They'll remain there until the property is sold.
But that estimate has come, the attrition of 1%, 2%, the 5%, that chart that we saw
is
pointed at 30 years is when that would actually settle.
Boy, that doesn't make sense that you use that as an exception then, does it?
Is that percentage, Lisa? Is that what is that a percentage of?
So the percentage of the total short-term rentals that are in the rural area, 22%, 272 of the 1,020 that are in the rural area are in the RW zone.
Not related to the 5% at all.
But that could be skewed because we're talking about doing them in different areas. I mean, that could be just all of Lake Wenatchee or Lake Chelan it would likely, areas along the Columbia River or other areas that are rural waterfront.
You're right, but if you look
far below that.
Yeah, if you look at the map, we kind of do. If you look at the maps, Lake Wenatchee has the highest amount of red, and Plain has the highest amount of red, and those are all RW.
So by the zoning area, it's a bit just...
coarse.
Yeah. So in... some areas it's going to be perfectly fine, in other areas it's going to be problematic.
Okay.
Should I withdraw my motion?
Oh, no. I don't think so. I think it's a good compromise, and we let this go to see where it goes, to see how it fleshes out.
Remember, you do have a I forget what we called it. It was basically the work group that's going to be convened to revisit the code and see how things are working within it. That's part of the proposal. And I had, when it was formerly in front of the county commissioners, I had no indication that they weren't willing to entertain that for taking a
task force.
The task force. In other words, to look at what gets put in place, see what we're learning as it's being implemented, and look for potential needed changes to be brought back to the commission and see whether they want to remand the process, not take the code over again, but simply say, okay, we want the planning commission to look at these certain things that we think weren't adequately addressed the first time around. That was the idea of the task force composition, to review this, not assume that this is baked in for all time in every single element, that there might be needed additions in the future, there might be edits to what we have, there could even be things that are stricken from this that are problematic or discovered to be problematic once we start implementing.
Even added, right?
Yeah, either way, my point is it would take an iterative approach and look at, okay, this is the best we're gonna get, for now, based on the information we have. And once we start applying it to the real world, we're going to learn things from that.
Right. I agree. That's why I think it's important for us to basically feel consensus on what we want to do here. The vote will show who voted for and against this. It's fine. Right. And I think even the commissioners might even look at how close this particular thing came and make a decision on that. Perhaps, I don't know what their thinking is.
Sure.
I would like to do a point of question, please.
We have a motion on the table. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed?
No.
So we have Ed opposing and everyone else is approving.
I opposed it.
Oh, sorry. Pat. Pat and Ed are opposing and everyone else is a yes.
The record will reflect that Ed and Pat voted against. Did anyone abstain?
No.
I would like to move that we accept this code as written and changed to progress forward to the commissioners.
I second it.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Woo!
Any opposed?
Great.
Motion carries, moves on to commissioners. Cheyenne County Commissioners, that is.
Right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for your hard work, planning commissioners. I know this has been a real tough time, and especially having to do it twice.
Mr. Brown, I have a question for you, if you don't mind. I'm wondering how you're viewing this moratorium regarding, in particular, the Manson UGA, where there are permits. If this isn't passed by the end of the year, will you be giving new permits to the Manson UGA?
No. If we absent a final code that takes effect before the end of the calendar year, it would require the county commissioners to revisit the moratorium to remove that provision. All new, which includes the new year in terms of the Manson UGA, new permits would be stopped because of the moratorium.
Okay. If a home sells in the Manson UGA right now, are you allowing that, if they're already permitted, are you allowing them to continue?
Yes, we are allowing the permit to run with the land for the balance of the calendar year.
And the last question is, if someone comes in today asking for a permit in the Manson UGA, are you processing that or are you saying, sorry?
We are not allowed to take that permit application in because of the restrictions created by the moratorium.
Okay, thank you very much.
On to new business, we've got an item, technical review group for the critical areas ordinance to discuss.
So this is a very brief item. I brought this up last meeting during the new business section. We have composed that technical working group of 9 positions in it involving folks from industry, state agencies, agency staff. And we were interested in bringing on, if there was a volunteer among you, at least one planning commissioner to be part of that process. This will run over the next couple of months, probably a couple meetings a month, reviewing draft code, having discussion about it. Christina Woolman will be facilitating the process. There'll be a community development person on it, starting it with at least me and possibly a new planner that we bring on board. And then get a more refined version of the code that meets the needs of the code changes and puts together a package to bring back to the Planning Commission for restarting that critical areas ordinance review in a more organized fashion than we were doing before.
So you're looking for a person from this body to sit on that to start with, correct?
Yes, it's not mandatory. I'm offering it as an opportunity because there might be a planning commission member that has a specific interest in that and might be able to provide a perspective from a planning commission perspective that we don't otherwise have at the table.
That's something I would like to do, but at the same time, I do not have the time to do that.
Again, I'm only offering it as an option. If nobody has the time or interest in that, you're a volunteer organization, you give us a lot of your time as it is, and that's fine. I just didn't want to cut you out and not give you an opportunity to have a member participate.
Are there any of you that would like to partake on that committee?
Well, I'll volunteer, and I just pray to God I've got time for it.
Well, Vicki, I don't want to overtask you. We don't anticipate it to take a long time in terms of, like, screen time. It'll be more of a come together, talk about issues, identify what the issues are. You've got reading materials and edits you might make, questions you might have. I know you did have questions when we were going through the process a couple months ago, that you could bring to that and ask the actual agency representatives who are part of the reason we have the code changes we have and get those questions answered and improve your comfort level. And if at any time you feel you need to drop out of that process that is just taking too much of your time, it's not like being a member of the Planning Commission. This is a work group. If you're not available, you're not available. I would just ask that if you are available and committed to it, that when you can, that you would participate.
Okay, that sounds good. I'll volunteer for that. Vicki, and I appreciate the fact that you're opening it up so a representative of the community or the people we represent is going to be a part of that. So thank you.
Vicki, if you'd like, you can use me as a resource as well.
Oh, please. Yeah, because you know I don't have the knowledge. Well, I've worked on this before. And I'm on the voluntary stewardship program, which is with regard to this for agriculture. So
thank you, Vicki. Next, we got upcoming meetings and possible date adjustments due to the holidays, where our November meeting would be typically Wednesday, November 25th, which is the day before Thanksgiving. And seeing if you'd like, as a board here, to adjust that to meet potentially earlier that week
or the week before,
or even the week before.
You mean like on the 18th?
That would be good.
And we'd have the same issue with Christmas as well.
Correct, because it's on a Friday.
December 16th. The proposal would be to move the meeting, November meeting, to the 18th, and the December meeting to the 16th. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I have no problem with that. If no objections, I'll move that we move those meetings to those dates.
I'll second that.
So we've got a first by Carl and a second by Joel. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Those are at 6 o'clock, correct?
That is correct.
What were the two dates again? Please repeat them.
The 18th of November and the 16th of December.
Great. Thank you.
And because even though this area went to phase two, we're still going to have to do it by Zoom.
Okay.
I
have no items under my discretion tonight.
Now, this is a special meeting. Are we still having our regular meeting too?
That will be on the 28th of this month.
Okay.
Do we have things to discuss, Jim?
The comp plan amendment workshop.
Right. So we have a workshop scheduled that Catherine will be leading that is a comp plan amendment workshop to discuss with you the comp plan proposals that we have. It's not the formal hearing and deliberation, it's the presentation on the proposals so you can start to understand what's on the table. And then the subsequent meeting would be the one where we had a hearing and potential vote.
So that's on the 22nd or the 21st, right?
Correct.
28th.
The 28th is your next meeting. The 28th of October is your
regular meeting, October 28th.
Yes.
6 o'clock.
Correct. Okay. Any other general items amongst planning committee?
Thank you for your work on this. I know I was a newcomer, but appreciate the work that you folks have done in the past.
Great.
Well, I'm glad the two of you came on board because you helped us to streamline it.
So I'm willing to take a motion for closure of tonight's meeting.
So moved.
Second.
We got a first from Vicki, a second from Carl. All those in favor?
Bye.
Have a wonderful evening, everyone.
Bye-bye. Brian, thank you very much. Mr. Brown, can I ask you a question before you leave?
Thank you. Yes, you can, Carl.
Are you in the process of finding another person to report?